What is your name?
My name's Stephen Elmore.
And where do you live?
I live in Ashland, Kansas.
What's your occupation?
I'm a salesman with United Telephone, United Wireless.
And how old are you?
62.
Okay. So when did you first become aware of the Starbucks fire? Hereafter, we'll refer to it as just the fire that happened on March 6th.
I was listening on the radio as I drove around. I spent a lot of time in the car, and so I was aware there was a large fire down in Clark County. But it really struck home when my wife called me and told me, I'm going to say it was about 2:30 or 3 o'clock, that she works for the school and that they had evacuated the school or told the community that they were going to evacuate the community. I'm the hospital board chair, and she told me they were evacuating the hospital as well. Maybe I ought to come home and be available.
So what was your immediate reaction when she was telling you this?
Holy smokes. I thought, well, this is going to be, what a nightmare. Of course, the first thing I thought about was from the hospital standpoint, evacuating all the people and the logistics of that and all that type of thing. I know we typically have plans in place for all those types of things. So, you know, you worry how well is the plan going to work when you have to implement it. And so I think that was my initial reaction. I need to get home so I can help any way that I can.
Did you have any trouble returning to Ashland?
Well, yeah. I couldn't get out of Dodge, for one, because they also had fires going on in Dodge City at the same time. And the highway out of town, it was all closed off because there were fires burning across it. So I took the country roads and went around west of the fire and then came down south of the fire and hit the highway going on down to Ashland. When I got to the Englewood Junction, west of town, there was a state worker in a truck, and Mark was there, and I drove up and rolled down my window, and he said, well, you can't go south, the road's closed. And I said, well, how about east to Ashland? He said, it's still open, but I don't know for how much longer. So I went ahead and drove into town. This was about 4:45 in the afternoon when I came through. And, of course, the wind was blowing out of the west at that point in time and almost blowing due east. And so all the smoke, you could see smoke south of the highway, probably 3 to 5 miles. There was nothing on the highway at that point in time. And so I was able to drive into town, clear roads, and not see any evidence of the fire until I got to what I'd call Gardner Valley, right there, the flat spot. You could see flames and everything down, way down south at that point in time. And it was a big fire.
So had Sally evacuated?
Yes. When I got home, she had already left. She had a sister that lives in Protection, and she had gone to her sister's house and was staying there with our two dogs. And so I came into town and, of course, drove by the hospital. The hospital was empty, so I knew there was nothing I could do there. I went to our house and pulled out some sprinklers and set them on the west side to try to hopefully help if fire came, then maybe it wouldn't catch our house on fire. And then I thought, well, what do I do? What do I grab? And I thought, you know, I don't know. So I went through and just did a video pictorial of everything in our house so that, you know, if we lost everything, I would at least have something to go back and remind me of what all was there so I wouldn't forget it.
So did you stay in contact with Sally?
We talked a couple of different times. And I know that they later had to evacuate. She evacuated her sister's house. Her sister and her brother-in-law, they stayed. They didn't evacuate. They just stayed. But she didn't feel comfortable, so she went ahead and went to Coldwater and stayed at the gymnasium in Coldwater with a lot of other people.
So did you stay in Ashland?
I left Ashland about 5:30 or 6 o'clock. When I set out the sprinklers and all that, I was in the backyard. It was about 5:30. And the wind shifted at that point in time and started coming out of the northwest, and all of a sudden the smoke went away. And I thought, wow, maybe we dodged the bullet. And then about 20 minutes later, smoke started rolling in. And my neighbor came over and asked me what I thought, and I said, you know, I know what the fire looked like out west. I don't know what the fire looked like up north. So I don't know what's coming or, you know, what we're in, you know, in the sights of. I need to get out of town a little further and look and see what's going on. So at that point in time, I drove out to the east edge of town along a tree road across the street from Beisel's property. And I pulled in there and was watching, and you could see the fire race over the hill from up northwest and start to come down. My neighbor pulled in beside me, and I told him, we're not far enough west, because the fire was threatening at that point in time, moving very rapidly, and we were in the path of the fire.
So did you know there were two fires at that time?
I didn't know. I knew there was a fire up north, because when I came south from Mineola, I saw the very beginning, I think, of one of the fires up north. And it was just right by one of the wind turbines. And it was a very small fire at that point in time. But I knew with that wind, you know, there's no telling what it'll do. And I think that is the fire that grew and then came down towards Ashland.
So how far west did you go?
Well, you know, I went from about a quarter mile, half mile west of town out to Garth Gardner's house and pulled into his driveway, which put me west of the fire and on a high spot that we could see. And at that point in time, we were actually, Garth was there too, and several other people. And we actually watched the fire at that point in time. That was about 6 or 6:45 when I shot some video that showed the fire jump the highway and go racing by the TV, what we call the TV tower, which is United's tower, go flying by it, headed right towards town. And I thought, we've lost town at that stage in the game. But that fire stayed west of town and burnt down to the, what would it be, southwest corner of town and missed town. So, and just missed our new hospital by about 300 yards.
So did you come back to town, or?
Well, at that point in time, there was still lots of fire, and there was another fire that was further west of the one and one further east, and there were multiple lines of fire coming down. And I realized at that point in time that probably I needed to get further west. And volunteer firefighters stopped by at that point in time and said, you guys need to move further west. You know, there's still plenty of fire all around. And, of course, the wind was blowing about 60 miles an hour, and so the fire was moving 60 miles an hour. They said, you won't have time to react. Just get further west to protect yourself.
So how far did you go?
Well, I went and drove across Gardner's, the creek right there. And I didn't like being there because you're down low and there's trees and you can't see over the hills. And I thought, I want to get up high where I can see to be sure that I'm safe. And so I actually went to the top of the hill right before you get to Kiger Creek and pulled off to the south side of the road and parked there and had a state trooper pull up beside me, and he sat there too. And we stayed there till about 12:30 or 1 o'clock in the morning and watched the fire. And I really thought Ashland had probably burnt at that point in time.
Did anybody come by?
The road was closed at that point in time, so there was nobody on the highway. Once in a while, a fire truck might come or go, but for the most part, they had the road blocked at the Inglewood Junction west of us, and then the road was also blocked east of town, so they weren't letting anybody into that area. I figured, I'm sitting with a state trooper. He's in radio contact. If we need to move, he's going to know it. And so I was fairly comfortable. And we sat and watched the fire for, you know, three, four hours. At that point in time, it was dark, and we could watch how things were moving and watch it burning all over the place. And, of course, there were fires everywhere. I mean, you know, you might have a tree row that was still on fire and burning. The wind calmed down, so it kind of settled down a whole lot at that point in time, and, you know, the fires weren't expanding as rapidly as what they did before that. But it looked like the whole countryside was on fire.
So kind of what was your reaction to that, your emotions?
You know, devastation. I mean, recognizing how extensive this fire was and how big it was, just from what I could see, the amount of area that was burnt. And like I said, we could see where the town of Ashland was, and there were big flames going, and you could see they'd been burning a long time. And that's what made me think that the town may have actually caught fire, but it hadn't. It was the out at the landfill. They have a big tree pile that was out there, and I think that's what was burning and causing all the big flames and everything there.
So was there lots of smoke? Could you see town through smoke? Or?
Well, at that point in time, the wind had stopped pretty much, and of course it was dark. You could see flames, but most of the smoke was going straight up, I think, at that point in town. Because there really wasn't any wind. It was virtually calm. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of a surreal situation, knowing all the chaos going on around and then being in the calm. So we just kind of sat, and the state trooper and I visited. He had been on duty since 5 that morning, and here it was midnight at night. And he was the guy that was in charge of the whole district at that point in time. So he had guys calling in and coming and going, and it was an interesting time frame.
So then did you go back to town?
Yeah, about 12:30, I looked at the officer and I said, it looks to me like the fire's gone south and west of town. And whatever in town is there looks to be fairly safe. I said, I'm guessing the highway's still closed. He said, yes. And I said, but it looks like I could take the southern dirt road and come into town on what we call the river road. And I think that that's a safe passage, but I don't want to do that if you don't want me to. And he said, I've been with you for a while. I'm a pretty good judge of character. I think you're smart. I don't think you're going to do anything stupid. He said, just be careful if you know the way in and out and around. He said, go ahead and go on in, and you can check and see what's going on. So I drove into town at that point in time, and I drove by the hospital and, of course, kind of drove around town and saw that nothing in town was burnt at that point in time. You could smell smoke everywhere. Went home, turned my sprinklers off because I figured they didn't need to be on anymore, and found the local law enforcement and reported to them that I was in town and said, I don't know what I need to do or if I need to leave town, but I can't go to protection or cold water, which is the evacuation center, because there's fire between me and there. He goes, you're right. You need to stay, on this side of the fire now. He said, tell you what, go ahead and go home. And if we get another close call or anything, I'll come by and check on you. I've got your cell phone number. I'll call you. Make sure you're out of town if we need to evacuate again. So I went home thinking, okay, what am I going to do? And, of course, the smell of smoke was so bad, I decided there's no way I can sleep. I'm too paranoid about the fire coming back. And so at that point in time, I'm going to say it was probably about 1 o'clock or something like that in the morning. Mm-hmm. I drove down to what was the emergency operations center at the emergency preparedness office. And because I'm in the communications industry, I checked in with Millie Fudge, our emergency management director, and said, Millie, I'm here. If there's anything I can do, if you need any communications help, let me know. And we sat down and talked for a while. And after a while, I looked at her and I said, what's the biggest concern you have headed forward that you don't know how you're going to take care of it other than the fire? And she said, I don't know how we're going to feed all these guys breakfast in the morning. And I said, I can take care of that. I had already received permission when I left work the night before, the day before, work had contacted me and said, you have a company credit card, anything that needs to be done, you do it, and let's take care of the community. Because Ashland is one of our telephone towns, and it's very important to us. That's our roots, so to speak. And so I had decided, okay, I'll just drive to Dodge and go to Walmart or Dillon's and buy all the frozen breakfast they have and everything like that and figure something out. And then I thought, well, wait a minute. McDonald's is open 24 hours a day. So I called McDonald's and I said, don't hang up on me. I said, I need to talk to the manager. And the manager came on the line and I said, this is not a crank call. I'm serious. I work for United Telephone on the south end of Dodge, and there's a massive fire in southern Clark County that we are trying to figure out how to feed all the firefighters. And I said, you know, I know you have just-in-time delivery of food, don't know what you have on hand, don't know that you can help us, but I'd been told that their best guess, maybe about 80 firefighters, half of them in Mineola, half of them in Ashland, Englewood. And so I said, can you do an order of 160 breakfast burritos and about 80 hash browns? And there was a long pause on the end of the phone, and the guy came back and goes, well, how soon do you want them? And I said, well, I'm probably about a half hour or 45 minutes away. And he said, oh, well, I can't have them that quick, but you might have to wait 15 or 20 minutes, something like that, but yeah. And I said, okay, I have a credit card. We'll pay for it all and take care of it. Go ahead and get started. And he told me, just drive through the drive-through when you get here. And so I drove up to Dodge. As I drove out of Ashland, went by our TV tower, we call it, which is our cell tower, too. And, of course, it was burnt completely around. There was a power line pole that was burning, and it burnt off at the ground, and the power line was kind of hanging over the road, and I was worried it was going to fall, but it was still up, so I drove on through. Talked to the roadblocks and told them I was on my way to Dodge to get breakfast, and I'd be back. And stopped at Walmart because Dillon's was closed. They weren't open 24 hours anymore. Right. And so I went to Walmart, bought like 4 cases of water, and then went to McDonald's because they said it would be a while before they'd have it, and pulled up and told them, I'm the guy with all the burritos. And they said, well, go ahead and pull up. And so we went ahead, and he asked me, he said, do you want these in a box? And I said, yeah, I need some to carry them in. And he said, okay. He said, well, we'll put, you know, everything in one box and bring it out to you. And he said, we'll put all the burritos in bags of 10, and then we'll put the hash browns in bags of 10. So you have some idea how many you have. And it was about 15 or 20 minutes later, they walked out and put a huge bag in the front seat of my car. And I took a picture of it and posted it on Facebook. So this is what 180 breakfast burritos and 80 hash browns looks like. Of course, my car smelled like McDonald's for about a week after that. Yeah. But then I drove back to Ashland from Dodge.
So when did you get back with the burritos? Like you said, you stopped in Mineola?
Yeah. It was about 2:45, I think, when I left Dodge. Mm. Of course, normal trip is about an hour drive time. But I had contacted Millie at the emergency management office and said, okay, I'm on the way. What do you want me to do? And she said, well, if you can, why don't you stop at the fire department in Mineola, and I'll have somebody meet you there for their crew. And so I met the chief at Mineola's fire department, gave them about half the food, and then drove on south. And when I got to Englewood Junction, the state still had the road blocked. I pulled up and said, how many guys here? And they told me they had 2. And so I gave them 4 breakfast burritos and a couple of hash browns and drove on. And then when I got to about Gardner's house, right there in the low spot east of their house, the highway patrol was there with the road blocked. And I pulled up, and he came over and he goes, oh, I remember you driving through here going to Dodge. And I said, well, I've got breakfast if you want breakfast, and gave him breakfast. And I said, is the power line still in the air? And he said, yeah, it's still up there, but we don't know for how long, so just be careful. So I drove on into town, I stopped at the EOC and left some food for them and then took the rest down to the fire station for them to hand out to the crews as they shuffled through the fire station. Then I sent a message to my office and said, we need to be prepared to fix lunch because we've got breakfast covered. I know that they will be able to do some staging and some things once it becomes daylight in the day, and their normal processes will kick in, but we need to help them out before those processes have a chance to kick in. And we have a couple of barbecue grills and a trailer. I said, bring down the trailers, bring a couple of couple of hundred hamburgers and hot dogs so that we can feed the fire crews a hot meal. Go from there. And so we had a crew that came down from Dodge and provided cookers, and we fired everything up and fed them at the fire station.
And you just set up at the Ashland fire station?
At the Ashland fire station.
And then everybody came there or sent out from there, right?
That was kind of the clearinghouse for the firemen. The EOC dispatched people, but they were dispatched over radio. Everybody staged through the fire station because with their trucks, they would come in there if they were close and fill up with water, get for the trucks, and then be able to also grab pallets or cases of water to throw on their fire trucks and have available, splash their face off. And they had provided, they have sack lunches and stuff like that, that I think it's the normal course of procedure that they do when they have fires. And so the firemen are used to cycling through there as they get, you know, as they go west or east past the fire station, they stop and grab stuff and go on from there.
So besides food, did you do anything with communications?
Yeah, we turned around and had a situation where talking with Millie, once they started staging the emergency preparedness, I'll call them strike team, that would come in, they realized that they were going to have five trailers there and different people doing different things. So what we did is we brought in some wireless routers to provide the internet connections for them, and then we also have some wireless landline alternatives that gave us the capacity that we could just set a box there. They could plug a desk phone into it and have a functioning phone and not have to worry about cell phones, could transfer handsets back and forth between people and still have their own cell phones so that their lines of communication with their personnel were still open. So we put those into play and got those all up and running while the state was still bringing in their resources to provide the backup.
Was this early Tuesday or?
Yes, this would have been. They brought them down when they brought the trailers with the grills and the burgers and hot dogs and all that stuff, and we brought down a bunch of water too from the office in Dodge. So we had all that stuff up and running by about, I'm going to say about 10 or 10:30 in the morning, Tuesday morning.
So did you spend a lot of time through the week until the fire was over at the EOC?
You know, I checked in with my office, and they said, just do whatever needs to be done. Anything that they need done, be there to help them. And so I just told Millie, I'm here to help, whatever you want me to do. And I spent a lot of time there just making myself available in any way that I could. And
so what kind of things did you do?
Well, they had personnel came in that they didn't have computer stations for, so I hooked up my laptop and let them use my laptop. I was there to do connectivity when guys would come in with laptops, then we would hook them up. I helped check in and check out firefighters and stuff like that. I turned around and, of course, that next evening, we had a situation, water started rolling in and resources started rolling in, and I started help unload trucks and whatever needed to be done. Because I know the area too, as the Black Hawk helicopter started flying in the next day, they were trying to communicate with them, and they were using the airport, and they needed somebody to take somebody out so they could talk to the Black Hawks. And so I said, well, here, I can drive somebody out there. I know where it is. That's fine. So went ahead and drove the guy, the emergency coordinator, out there and just made myself available, things like that. I ran errands, would go deliver stuff, pick stuff up, worked with the dispatch in that regard.
So how many days?
You know, I worked up a full week, probably. It was, I mean, the fire started on Monday, and I think it was Tuesday afternoon of the following week that I finally went back to the office and checked in. Because at that point in time, everything was winding down and getting back to normal.
So what stands out most vividly? What's your most vivid memory of the fire?
You know, I'm a religious person, and the thing that struck me was the Lord's intervention at precise times. I can't help, one of the most vivid time frames for me was I was in the EOC, and this would have been Tuesday afternoon. And, of course, people were calling in saying, hey, I've got fire headed to my house, my barn. You know, I'm going to lose everything. What can I do? And, of course, we would call, they would, dispatch would call and tell the fire crew that was close there, you know, so-and-so is being threatened, and they would try to go over and help them. And I remember one call coming in talking about our house and barn, our barn just caught on fire, the house is threatened. And I can remember the dispatcher saying, well, we don't have any units available that we can dispatch. Keep yourself safe. We will try to help if we can, but in the meantime, just be safe. And we'll try to get help to you. And I remember them disconnecting. And I just remember thinking to myself, we've lost the war. And at that point in time, I had to leave the building, and I walked outside. Because we were stretched so thin, and I knew the firefighters at that point in time had been, some of them had been on the truck since 10:30 the day before. When they got called out and got, they were going to go help fight the fire in Oklahoma, got to Inglewood and realized it's going to be here, we don't need to go fight in Oklahoma, and stayed there and staged and started protecting stuff down there. So I knew these guys were getting exhausted, because they had been fighting the fire for so long. And I just, you know, my emotions, I'd had a couple hours of sleep is all I'd had, just kind of taking a nap. And my emotions just started welling up thinking it's all over. And right at that point in time, there was also a call that came in that a house in town had caught on fire. And, of course, fire departments keep town trucks on reserve in case a house catches on fire just for that reason. And so they went and went to go fight that. And I can just remember thinking, it's over. We've lost, you know. Nature's going to win. And right then, the first strike team from Colorado showed up. And they showed up with 8 trucks and 16 guys. And they said, you know, they came walking up and they said, we're here. Where do we need to go check in? And I just bursted out in tears, and the guy hugged me and said, don't worry, we're here to help. And they left immediately. He said, we left this morning at 6:30 this morning. We've been driving all day to get here. And as I said, that was about, I think, about 4 o'clock. Mm-hmm. And they said, you know, at this point in time, we'll check in, we'll go up and fight this fire up on the lake road is where it was at that point in time. Mm-hmm. We'll analyze it, stop it if we can, and then, you know, let you bring crews, but we're about out of hours, we've got to shut down. And then they took off, and then right after them 4 more strike crews showed up, and it was just like waves. They just kept coming in just in the nick of time.
So have you ever had any other experiences with wildfires before?
I've not been involved in fires. I mean, I've been involved in disasters. I worked the Greensburg tornado. Mm-hmm. I was in emergency response with Caterpillar. I worked for Caterpillar in the power generation industry, and I provided generators. And I was in Greensburg the morning after the tornado hit to come in and help staff up for the emergency management teams to come in and set up their emergency operations centers and provide power.
Pretty much the same type of communication type?
I didn't do communication. I did electricity. The guy that provided the electricity for everything to hook up. Yeah. And so that was, you know, kind of a unique situation. you asked about neat things. The other thing was that next night, Tuesday night, when all the fire crews were here, the school, of course, stepped up and said, you know, they canceled school a couple of days early to send the kids on spring break. And the staff at the school said, we'll put all the people up, have the firefighters come stay at the school, we'll use the cafeteria, we'll feed them, all that kind of thing. So everybody staged at the school. And about 12:30 that night, I think it was, a local city showed up and said, we've got, you know, a couple of pallets of water for firefighters. We want it just for the firefighters. That's what it's for. And so we drove up to the school, and all the fire trucks were parked in the parking lot. And, you know, there were a total of, when it was all said and done, of 94 fire trucks and 192 firefighters, I think is what the count was. But we took and put a case of water beside every truck that night, so when they came out in the morning, they could just grab it and throw it on their truck and go on from there. So the outpouring of the public and the everything at the from the onset was just unbelievable.
So were there some of the people or agencies that proved to be most helpful?
You know, it was interesting watching, you know, having been through the Greensburg tornado, that was right after Katrina. And so FEMA was very sensitive about that situation. And I remember the response in Greensburg before, everything was going along real well with local people, and then FEMA came in and everything stopped. And they said, this won't happen, this is the way it's going to be, and they took control of everything and changed everything. And in a lot of cases, it was for the worst. I'm sure they thought it was for the better, but it really shut down the volunteer efforts and a lot of things. In the case of Ashland, some of the people that were in charge and some of the emergency operation personnel that came in, of course, had been through the Medicine Lodge fire the year before and had learned a lot from that. So there was a high level of experience, and some of the people said, you know, you have a choice. You can either control this fire, Millie, or you can let somebody step in and control it. It's your choice. And they kind of said under their breath, you know, if you have somebody else control it, then you lose control of the fire. And she said, I think we need to keep control. And so she rose to the task and did a great job, you know. And all the people that helped her, it was phenomenal. I mean, there's a team of, I think there were 11 emergency management directors that came in. Each had a certain job, and they did it. And worked very hard to make sure that it worked. Sometimes the bureaucracy of other agencies got in the way of making things happen. There were some problems with flying in and having airplanes. And, of course, there was another fire. The Hutchinson fire was going on, too, which had substantially more people threatened because of population back there. And so the state was real focused on there because that was in the news. There was no talk about the fire here. We even had firefighters that came here that had been in Hutch for 2 days sitting and couldn't fight fires because they had too many firefighters. And they said, we're here to fight fires. I remember a Benton fire team that came in and said, we called our chief and said, we're just sitting here, we're leaving, and we're going to Clark County because they still need help. And, you know, so that's, they're coming from Lawrence. I mean, we had fire teams from South Dakota that were here. It was just amazing.
Did you participate in the daily meetings?
Yes, I was. I kind of was the fly on the wall. That was the neat thing for me. That's what really made me feel really good about watching it all is, you know, I didn't have an official capacity, but I was told I had an unofficial capacity and not to worry about it. And so I was able to listen in and be a part of some of those meetings and understand what was going on. And, you know, I just tried to stay out of the way.
So who was part of those meetings?
You have the emergency management team, and that team is made up of the what they call the strike commander, which was Millie Fudge, the local emergency manager. And then she had all of the regional team that would come in, and each one of them would be assigned to different areas. One guy would be communications. One guy would be fire coordination. One guy was the resource manager, and different things like that, you know. And they would be in touch with, like, the state, the National Forest Service. I mean, a lot of these teams that came in from Colorado and Wyoming and New Mexico and South Dakota, those are all forestry teams that were called in by the State Forestry Service to man up and fight the fire. I asked the guys, I remember asking a couple of them, I said, so you've been on some big fires, because I lived in Colorado for a while, and I knew some of the big fires that some of these guys talked about being on. I remember them as big forest fires on the Front Range. And I said, how's this fire compare? And they said, you know, said, we've never been on anything this big. You know, at that point in time, we knew it was 700, 800,000 acres, you know, lots. They said, I've never been on a fire bigger than 150 to 200,000 acres. So this fire was three, four times bigger than anything they'd ever fought. They said, the big difference, I said, yeah, but we don't have the mountains. They said, but you got some ravines and some rocks that are just as big as we run into. Said, the difference here is they go down, they don't go up. Said, we can see the fire here. Where we fight fires, we usually can't see it. We just see smoke. And we have trees everywhere, so you can't see anything. You don't have trees. But your grass is 5 foot tall and over the hoods of our fire trucks.
So were there any local people at those meetings in the morning?
Yes, there were. What you had is you had the fire team's commanders, and each one of those strike team commanders, they were able to coordinate with the drop people, the airplanes that were flying and the helicopters that were dropping, because they had the communication capability. But each one of those guys had a local guy with them so that they had somebody that could tell them the lay of the land. So if dispatch called and said, yeah, we've got a fire out at Denison's, or we got a fire out at Gardner's or Giles, you know, out at Lake Road 23 miles or whatever their nomenclature is, we had people that knew those locations, and then they functioned as directors and guides for the teams. So it was a very good coordinated effort.
What do you think you can do as a person to prepare for a future fire, or what the community can do?
I think one of the things we look at and talk about, you know, I was struck by, what do I grab? Okay? I mean, what's important? What can't I replace? And I made the mention to my wife. I said, we need to go through and we need to put together a grab box that has, like, insurance policies and birth certificates and passports and things like that that are in a place that we can grab and go when we need to grab and go. The other thing we've talked about is just buying a fireproof safe so that we could keep it in that, so that it was always protected, but if we needed to evacuate or go, we could open it and grab it and go. I talked to a lot of the people that lived in countries and talked about how the fire burnt right up to their house and quit. You know, we talked divine intervention time and time and time again. I know they had a community meeting and people talked about how the fire would be burning straight at the house and all of a sudden just change directions and spare their house. It made you cognizant of maybe what vegetation you had by your house. You thought about those types of things a little more. You know, if there was a fire coming, you know, am I contributing to that fire and contributing to the potential, or am I inhibiting that fire and potential? The other thing I've thought, you know, our firefighters are volunteers. Mm-hmm. And I've talked to our fire chief and I've said, you know, I'm out of town all the time, you know, but I sit and I wanted to help, but I knew you can't let me help you, you know. So maybe I need to figure out what I can do. And his comment to me was, you know, being able to drive a truck makes a big difference. So there's lots of little things that can be done. I mean, I spent time at the fire hydrants where the trucks would come in and fill and basically just turn hydrants on and off. You know, carried water, provided food. There are lots of things that can be done in an event that big, but most of the time you don't have something that lasts for 9-10 days.
So what do you think the community can do to prepare?
You know, one of the things we talked about, because we did recaps of everything and what worked, what didn't work, what do we need to do better. Being on the hospital board, of course, we're moving out of the old hospital and the new hospital real shortly. The discussion of, we have a generator. Do we want to make that generator available to some other facility so that in the event of extreme situations, be it an ice storm, be it a windstorm, firestorm, whatever, if we hadn't had power in this town, it would have made things a whole lot more difficult. You start talking about water wells. How do you pump the water up to the water tower? Being an emergency generator business before, I've been through many ice storms and I've pulled up to towns when they didn't have electricity and their water tower was empty, and I had the generator that was going to power up the city pump. You know, so we need to look at those things. We need to think about those things. And there's a lot of that stuff going on. But it's amazing, a year from now, 2 years from now, and people will forget about it and go on from there.
Okay, so you're in communications. How did the fire affect United Telephone's structure of its, how it delivers telephone and internet to the places? Where did they have any losses?
Yeah, we actually, we're still fighting that. We call that infrastructure. A lot of that infrastructure in our business, we have elected to put underground. And the advantage of that is it's not as susceptible to ice damage, to fires, things like that, like the electrical. I know that CMS, the rural electrical area around here, and the city, just in some of the short runs out of town, spent a lot of time repairing lines that had burnt, you know, poles had burnt down, and so lines came down. From our standpoint, most of our stuff is underground or wireless. Mm-hmm. Because this fire moved so fast in a lot of cases, it burnt right by our towers and didn't hurt it. We have gravel around all these facilities just for those reasons, so that if there is a fire, it doesn't actually burn up to our building. We have generators that back it up. We have propane tanks that power them, things like that. And so they're designed to typically survive those isolated situations.
Yep.
But if you look at how we build stuff, they run it underground until they run out of cable, and then they come up out of the ground, make a connection to the next cable, and go back down to the other one. And if you know what to look for, you can drive along the road and you see them every couple of hundred yards because they ran out of cable. Mm-hmm. And those are called PEDs, where they come up and make those connections. And in those connections, then, where they're above ground, we may have had some cabling, some insulation that melted in some of those cases if the fire stayed around it and was hot enough. In the country, we may have lost some of the connections to houses and stuff like that, where the connections on the outside of a house may have burnt. We have a very extensive wireless network that covers our southwest quarter of the state, which is our home territory. And in most counties, we have 3 to 5 wireless communication towers and cell phones, and those have battery backups as well as generators. But we hauled fuel to those sites, and we had things that went down. The other thing that we did is we provided cellular phones to the guys that came in from out of state that had a carrier whose services didn't work here. So we made phones available to a bunch of those guys so that they would be able to communicate as a last resort.
So did you have any physical or financial damage yourself?
Personally, no, I did not. I live in town. My house was not affected. Everything smelled like smoke, but everything and the whole town smelled like smoke for weeks. You know, it took, we got some rains that next week that, you know, usually they say lightning creates ozone and will dissipate that, but the smell was so thick with smoke that, I mean, it was literally weeks before it finally subsided.
So is there anything that kind of strikes you as funny or something that you can't forget about the whole week of fire or things, something that happened that just kind of stands out in your mind?
You know, there are multiple things that happened, you know, that you sit and you look and you go, wow. The biggest thing was the aid that came pouring in from outside the region. You know, we have people here now in town building fence, volunteering to build fence. It made me very proud of my community to see the people step up the way they did and throw in the way they did to help. We had towns, you know, in the northwestern part of the state. Sharon Springs was a town that all those kids gave up their spring break and came down here and helped. You know, I mean, and we had kids out of WSU. We had a squadron or part of a squadron of airmen that called up from McConnell Air Force Base and said, we don't know how to build fence or anything else, but we're young and we're strong and, you know, we'll come out and help haul off trash, you know, and stuff like that. I mean, the outpouring was just phenomenal. And it was just amazing to watch all that. You know, as far as individual stories and stuff like that, just the total outpouring of everything. And the way everything worked when the bureaucrats got out of the way and let the people do things. There were some snafus. There were some problems. I mean, we had farmers who said, use my lake to dip out of with the helicopters to put the fire out with. And the state came in and said, no, you can't do that because we don't have signed permission letters from these people. You know, just little things like that. You know, we had equipment that they were begging for that was a day late getting here because they wouldn't release them from someplace else to come here. And they weren't being used at the other place. Just, you know, it's politics at its worst. And usually when you let the politics go away and let the people react, in most cases, the people do a phenomenal job.
They do. So do you have any other thoughts about this experience that you'd like to include? Anything we forgot?
Just a big thank you to everybody. I mean, the amount of personal work that went into this. There are little old ladies that called and said, our church wants to provide a meal, you know. Church doesn't have any money, you know, but yet they're like, we'll do whatever we can to help. The amount of preparedness, I know there are a lot of people that, you know, we have a camp in town that wasn't ready for the camping season, that a bunch of people went down and said, we need to get this open so that we can put people up in bunks and give them showers and all that kind of thing. And they spent multiple days working on everything to get it up and operational. And then once the school spring break was over, we were able to transition them out of the school down to the camp and provide that. And the camp has been open, you know, all spring, summer for people to stay that have volunteered to come down. Watching all the semi-loads of hay and fencing equipment and, you know, crews coming in to volunteer and help. It makes you proud to be an American and proud to be a rural American to see the response of rural America.
So when did your wife come back?
The next day, actually. Late the next day. I think about 8 or 9 o'clock, something like that. She came back from Coldwater, checked in with her sister to make sure they were still all right, and then came on home.
Did she help with the volunteer stuff?
Or yeah, was she busy at school? She works at what's called the Tabitha House. And the Tabitha House was trying to schedule clothing, anybody that needed immediate clothing, come in and get it, and some things like that, and then some coordination of that type of thing. Did some meals, came in and helped with food service and stuff like that at the high school in the very first stages. You know, there were just lots of things going on and lots of people volunteering.
When did you get your first full night of sleep?
Well, the fire was Monday, started Monday morning. Monday evening, Tuesday morning early, I got a couple hour nap. And then I think it was about 9:30 or 10 o'clock, be Tuesday night, I went home and I slept hard until about 7 or 8 in the morning and then got up and went back down to the UOC. So, I mean, it was, you know, I was much more fortunate than a lot of other people because I really didn't have a job. I was just there to do anything that needed to be done. So people weren't counting on me, and I just said, you know what, I'm going to go sleep until I'm tired of sleeping, you know, until I wake up, and then I'll get up and make myself available, and I'll be more useful that way. And that came in handy because, of course, we worked until, you know, 12, 1 in the morning, just about every morning those first few days,
so they,
staging stuff for the firefighters and stuff like that.
So they did close the EOC at some point? I mean,
no,
like,
it was open 24/7.
Someone was there all the time.
Someone was there all the time. I don't think the EOC closed until probably, I'm going to say 2 weeks after the fire. I think the last firefighters left.
They left on Saturday.
I was going to say, late Friday, they were destaging and planning to get out Saturday. So
the county was turned back over to the local firefighters at 11 o'clock on Saturday.
Okay. And I thought there was, one crew stayed overnight Friday night and was still on standby, but it was pretty much mopped up at that point in time from what we were seeing. But after the fire's over, then comes the paperwork. And when you deal with a disaster like this, the mounds and mounds of paperwork that have to be done and processed, because you have to account for all the resources that were used, everything that was mobilized, everything is key on what went well, what went bad, how do we improve. It's a growing process constantly so that the next time they're better equipped. And my hats are off to the Kansas emergency personnel for the level of coordination and activities that they were able to pull off. It was a phenomenal feat when you look at it and think of how everybody came together from different parts of the state to make it happen.
So anything else?
I mean, I could go on and on with stories, but they're the same stories that other people are saying too. It's just, you know, the thing is, you know, you look now and you don't really see the signs of the fire. I mean, I remember right after the fire going out and taking pictures of the surrounding communities and how close it came to town. And then a week later after the rain, I mean, 3 days later after the rain, there was grass starting to sprout everywhere. Mm-hmm. And 10 days later, everything was green again. It was amazing the recovery that was able to happen because the Lord provided the rain and we were able to go forward from there. So,
thank you for your time. Appreciate you coming in and giving us your story.
My pleasure.
Thanks.